This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Danny Hillis was part of the generation of computer scientists who worked at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab in the 70s. While they were supposed to be working on computer vision and robotics, they would go in at night and develop fun things like word processing, email, and video games. This after-hours activity ended up producing the computer applications that are now an integral part of our lives. As a kid, Danny Hillis built a computer out of Tinker Toys and dreamed of being a Disney Imagineer, which is what he is today. As Vice President of Research and Development at the Walt Disney Company, he helps design theme parks and other high-tech entertainment products. He's now written a book called The Pattern on the Stone, The Simple Ideas That Make Computers Work. Danny Hillis's first revolutionary contribution to computing was the then radical idea of parallel processing. He went on to form his own company called Thinking Machines. I asked him to explain parallel processing.
The idea behind parallel computers is pretty simple. Instead of trying to make one computer very fast, you use lots and lots of slow computers together. So you sort of divide up the task between many computers. Now, the reason that's a good idea is because slow computers are very cheap. They're manufactured in large quantities. So if you can just use a big pile of them, it's a very cost-effective way of getting a fast computer. It sounds like almost a trivial idea. And in fact, these days, it's the way that all the very fastest computers are built. In the mid-80s, when I first started working on it, there were some mathematical reasons why people thought that it wouldn't work very well. And I guess we demonstrated that that wasn't true by actually building them and getting them to work.
Give us an example of just how powerful, how fast it is. What fast means?
Well, one of these big, massively parallel computers could be, say, 1,000 or even 10,000 times faster than the computer that you have on your desk. Now, why would anybody want such a thing? Obviously, you don't care if you're running word processing to have that happen 10,000 times faster. But what people use them for is things like designing an airplane. It would be very nice to know if the airplane's going to fly before you put a test pilot into it. And it turns out you can figure that out on the computer, but it requires a long time and a lot of computation. Using a big parallel computer, it doesn't require such a long time, so you can try out a lot of different variations of the airplane and design a more efficient airplane, which is one of the reasons why airplanes use a lot less fuel now and are a lot quieter and so on, because they're designed using these supercomputers.
If everybody was telling you that there are mathematical reasons for this, that this wouldn't work, how do you know you could prove them wrong?
First of all, I have to say I didn't understand any flaw in their argument. So it wasn't that I saw their argument was wrong. But what I did know is that the human brain was able to do computations much faster than a computer. And if you think about that, that's a clue that we must be building computers in the wrong way. So for instance, I can write a face recognition program on a computer, but it would take many hours to recognize a face and it would do it inaccurately. And yet every two-month-old can recognize the face of his mother. So the computer is somehow organized in a way that makes it less efficient. And it's a matter of organization, because the actual components of the computer, the transistors, are much faster than the components that your brain is built out of. So a transistor is much faster than a neuron, and yet the brain does the job much faster than the computer. So that gave me the basic clue that it was possible that somehow it had to be true that you could use these components together in parallel to do computations faster. And since I was interested in doing that kind of computation, things like recognizing images or doing common sense reasoning, I just sort of bombed ahead without really knowing what was wrong with the mathematical arguments. And fortunately, it worked. And then afterwards, we figured out what was wrong with those arguments that said it was impossible.
There's an idea now to use computers linked through the internet, through local networks to work together. I think it's called distributive computing. It sounds similar to parallel computing. Did it grow out of
Yeah, it's a type of parallel computing. It should work in principle. One of the problems with using the internet is while it's very fast as far as people are concerned, it's not particularly fast as far as computers are concerned. So they spend an awful lot of time talking with each other and trying to keep coordinated. But I think there's a lot of progress in that area. So it will definitely happen for some sorts of computations.
Do you think it's an important element of the future of the Internet?
Well, I do think that it's interesting when we start using the Internet as a computer as opposed to just a telephone system, a glorified telephone system. Right now, almost everything that goes over the Internet is something that's basically looked at by humans. So it's words of text, or it's pictures, or it's sound. It's not really something understood by the computers. When the computers start talking in ways that are meaningful to the computers, that they're actually doing this kind of distributed computation, then we have potential for much more kind of interesting behavior to emerge. So you could almost imagine the idea of the Internet being a kind of giant global brain that's thinking thoughts. Interesting enough, that's not a new idea. It goes back from way before the Internet. As soon as electricity came out, people started thinking of this and sort of realizing the possibility that we were kind of building a nervous system across the whole globe. And I think that's actually really happening now.
I think your slogan for your company that marketed the massively parallel computers, Thinking Machines Corporation, was, and correct me if I get this wrong, we're making computers that are proud of us?
That's right.
Sorry, what were you trying to convey with that?
Well, I think it was a kind of a stake in the ground to say that we're really interested in this other way of using computers. Right now, as you mentioned, computers really are mostly used to handle old kind of media. So they're used to handle pictures and words, which essentially came off of paper, or sounds that were humans talking to each other in their voice. And so they really don't understand anything about what the content of those pictures are, what the words mean. And I think that the really interesting thing about computers is, in principle, they can actually understand the meaning of the words, not just the letters of the words. Or they can understand the processes that produce the pictures. And to me, that's the more interesting side of computers. It's the unrealized side of computers. It's the part of computers that we don't quite understand how to do yet, and we're just experimenting with yet. But I think it's going to, in the long run, be the much more important part of computers.
What are the implications of the Internet becoming a kind of global brain?
Well, I think one interesting thing about the Internet is, because it's not understood, it has the potential of having forms of behavior that weren't really designed into it. And we call this emergent behavior, that somehow the whole is more than the sum of the parts. Now, we've actually seen that in the Internet a couple of times where the behavior has been bad. It's been, for instance, the time that the virus went through the computers and shut down the Internet, in effect. And it is quite possible that forms of behavior will evolve which are beneficial and will encourage them. And I think it's a little bit hard to predict what that's going to be. But I guess in the extreme, potentially a computation could evolve on the Internet eventually that would actually start talking with us.
What do you mean by talking with us?
Well, it's an old idea from science fiction that somehow if you hooked enough computers together and let them evolve and let a computation evolve on it, eventually it would become intelligent. And by talking with us, I mean that, you know, an intelligent entity would appear that could have a conversation with us. And I'm talking far out science fiction stuff, but I don't think there's anything that makes it scientifically impossible. And I find it a kind of plausible scenario.
I thought the underlying assumption in computer science is that you can't make machines more like the human brain.
Well, that's a myth about computer science. The idea that we could make machines more like the human brain is a very threatening idea to people. And so philosophers like to explain why it's impossible in this. There's a whole history of philosophers explaining why computers couldn't do various things and then being proved wrong. When I first started studying computers, there were philosophers who said that computers could never play chess like a human being, and that that was a sort of fundamentally human attribute. There are people who say things like computers can't make mistakes or can't surprise you. I think that those are just kind of ways of us reassuring ourselves that we're important, and there's really not any real scientific basis for them. It's true that computers right now are very simple and stupid, and they're probably more like the brain of a cockroach than the brain of a human. But there's nothing inherent in them that prevents them from growing and getting more interesting.
Are there practical applications being used right now or developed that would allow the internet to think?
One interesting thing about progress in artificial intelligence is every time you actually get a computer to do something, it ceases to become artificial intelligence. So there was a time when, for instance, voice recognition was considered an amazing thing that required thinking. And now you often run into voice recognition circuits on directory services, for instance. There was a time when spelling correction impressed people, and now that's just something you assume computers can do. There was a time when computer vision was considered something that required intelligence, but now there's boxes all over the place that, for instance, on manufacturing lines that look at objects and see if they meet the specifications. So I think what we'll see for a long time is this kind of gradual progress. You'll see applications occurring that you won't see as breakthroughs, that just seem like the sort of normal progress of computers. And increasingly, when you see something happen, it may be happening with several computers working together across the internet. I remember one time recently I was demonstrating a simple artificial intelligence program to someone. And they said, oh, my computer does that. And I said, well, I'm very surprised that your computer does that because I think this is the only computer that can do it. And they said, no, I'm sure my computer does that. And I traced it down. Well, it turned out that their computer, in fact, did do that. But the way that it did it is their computer hooked through the internet to my computer and asked my computer to do it. Now, they didn't even know that they were using my computer. But it was because it was sufficiently invisible. So I think you'll increasingly see things that are happening like that, but you probably won't even recognize them as happening across the internet.
Danny Hillis's new book is The Pattern on the Stone, The Simple Ideas That Make Computers Work. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Disney Imagineer and computer scientist Danny Hillis. You've written a lot about the convergence of biology and technology, that we've reached a point where technology can take on almost biological processes like evolution. I'd like you to talk more about that.
I think it used to be that technological artifacts were simple, controllable things, and biological things were complicated and totally ununderstandable, and you just had to live with them. Both of those things are changing. Technology is becoming much more complicated, and it kind of has a life of its own. And biology is actually becoming much more controllable. We can actually gene splice and control and things like that. So I think the distinction between biological things and technological things is actually starting to blur. A good example of that is evolving computer programs. It used to be the only way of designing a computer program was a kind of engineering approach. You wrote each line of code like you were writing a novel. Well, now it's possible to actually evolve a computer program by a method that's very analogous to biological evolution. So what you do is you create inside the computer an environment, and you fill that environment up with computer programs, which can start out to be completely random computer programs. And you just let them live in that environment. You select them according to how well they do whatever you want to do. So if you want them to arrange things in alphabetical order, you just allow the things that tend to arrange things in alphabetical order to survive, and you kill the rest of them. And then you actually allow the ones that survive to breed with each other and produce children that inherit their traits. And in a computer, you can actually simulate generations and generations of these programs evolving in this environment. And after a few thousand generations, sure enough, they're very good at arranging things in alphabetical order or doing whatever it is you're selecting them for. Now, the interesting thing about that way of producing a computer program is when it's finished, you can look at the program and you can't describe how it works, but you can just see how it works. So it is much more like a biological organism, that you can see what it does. You can kind of select it a bit. You can do selective breeding to get it to do more what you want, but you really don't know how it works. So there's a very literal sense in which it is almost like a biological organism. I think you're going to start seeing a lot more of that happening.
When you say that you no longer really know how it works, is that a scary specter for you or only for us laymen listening to you talk about it?
Well, it's interesting. If I produced a program like that, I would actually have more faith that it works than I would if some very smart programmer programmed it. Now, that sounds crazy, but if you fly in an airplane, would you rather fly with a human pilot or would you rather fly with an autopilot designed by a bunch of engineers? I would personally rather have the human pilot. Well, I don't know how the human pilot works. I do know how the autopilot works, and I do know how the engineers work, which is what scares me. It turns out understanding things doesn't necessarily mean that that's the most robust way of doing it. Now, I have faith in the human pilot because I know that that pilot comes from a long line of people that survived. And so somehow there's generations of people who had enough survival instinct to do whatever it was necessary to stay alive. So I trust somehow that that pilot will do whatever's necessary. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the plane. So I trust the process in some sense that created the pilot, the training program, the hiring process, and so on. In the same sense, when I evolve a program, I trust the process. I know, to take my example, that at the end of 10,000 generations, I have a program whose life depended on sorting things correctly, putting things in alphabetical order correctly. And it comes from a long line of programs that survived by doing that, that have been tested in lots of possible ways. Just to take another step, you can actually evolve not just the programs, but the test routines that test the programs. So normally when you test a computer program, somebody, usually the same person that writes the program, thinks of a few tests to see if it's working. Well, they're not likely to think of all the odd cases. So, for instance, people who were writing payroll programs in 1950 didn't think of what happened when you got to the year 2000. If they had thought of those cases, they probably would have written the program correctly. When you evolve a program and evolve the test cases along with it, what happens is tests evolve that find bugs in the program that you never would have thought of. So I'm convinced that if you'd use evolutionary techniques to produce a lot of software that controls, that keeps track of what data it is, that we wouldn't have a lot of the millennium bug problems that we have now.
Do you think the millennium bug hoopla is exaggerated?
I have to be very careful about how I answer that question, because I do think that people who depend on computers should be spending some energy to see what will happen with those computers when the year 2000 comes. And if you have anything with a microprocessor on it, you should ask yourself, does that microprocessor know what data it is or depend on what data it is? So I do think there's a certain amount of responsible action that ought to be taken. Having said that, yes, I do think that the consequences of the Millennium Bug have probably been exaggerated. It's to the expert's advantage to say how terrible it might be. If you're writing a Sunday supplement, it's good to start with a lead about airplanes falling out of the sky or pacemakers stopping or something like that to grab people's attention. But I think those are actually pretty unlikely. In fact, I think what will happen is a lot of pretty trivial things. So it may very well be that certain bills will arrive late or some insurance policies get canceled by accident. And some of that will cause real inconvenience. I mean, it may be if welfare checks are late, I'm sure that would cause a real problem. But I don't think it's a world-stopping kind of a thing. Society is pretty resilient, and I think it'll be a glitch, and we'll get past it. I think right now there's almost a danger that we've oversold it, and there's a danger that the that we will create a panic. So right now, I think one of the worst scenarios is people will be so afraid of the millennium bug that there'll be a big stock market crash. Everybody will pull their money out. So I think there's a danger of irrational fear about it also. But actually, can I say one more thing about
Yeah, sure.
I think, to me, one of the things that's most interesting about the millennium bug is that people are so interested in it. And, you know, of all the possible bad things that can happen, why is it that this one has kind of captured people's imagination? And I think the reason for it is that that it's a hint for a lot of people of that things are really more complicated than they understood them to be. So it's the first time they've realized that the experts don't actually know what's going on. There's not somebody back in the computer room that really understands how this computer program works. And that's a sort of shocking concept, that we have now made technology so complicated that we don't understand it in detail. So I think a lot of people's interest in the millennium bug is really their interest in that.
Danny Hillis is the author of The Pattern on the Stone. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's get back to our conversation with computer designer Danny Hillis. He pioneered the concept behind the first supercomputers. Hillis now works as an Imagineer for Disney. His new book is The Pattern on the Stone, The Simple Ideas That Make Computers Work. You've been working on something called the Millennium Clock, or the Long Now Project. Why don't you tell us what it is and what's the thinking behind it?
Well, I got very interested in the problem that the future seemed to be shrinking. When I was a little kid, growing up in the 60s, people thought of the year 2000 as being the future, and they really tried to imagine what it would be like. But now it's 1999 or 98, and the year 2000 is still just two years away, and yet it's still what people think of as the future. People aren't thinking of what happens in the year 2050. So it's as if it's a kind of a mental block that people can't think beyond the millennium. And I think that that kind of short-term thinking causes a lot of problems to seem like they're impossible. So people basically only think of a problem as solvable if it's solvable in 2 or 3 years. The story that really got me thinking about this was a story I heard about Oxford University. They have a college there called New College, which is called New because it was made in the 15th century. It started in the 15th century. And the common room of New College had these big oak beams that needed replacing. And this was fairly recently that they needed replacing. And these days you can't just go down to a lumber yard and buy a 40-foot oak beam. So they started looking around trying to find a source of giant oak trees that they could make these beams out of. And what they discovered was that sitting right next to New College was a grove of oaks that had been planted for the purpose of replacing those beams in a few hundred years when they wore out. And that really struck me that that was a very different way of thinking about the world than we have today. I mean, you can't imagine today somebody building a building and planting some acorns so that there'll be oak trees to fix the building in a few hundred years. And I started thinking about how can we regenerate that kind of long-term thinking. What the Millennium Clock Project is about is actually trying to undertake a project that in some sense doesn't get finished for 10,000 years. So what I'd like to do is build a very big, very slow clock that ticks off the millennia as they go by. So imagine that this clock will strike 2 in the year 2000, but then it will strike 3 in the year 3000, 4 in the year 4000, and so on. And I find that thinking about this project stretches out your sense of time. You start thinking, well, what's the world really going to be like in the year 3000 when the clock strikes 3? And for example, if I put the clock in San Francisco, is it going to be underwater? Or if I make the clock depend on people winding it, you know, what will those people be like? So it starts a very different chain of thinking, and all of a sudden the year 3000 starts feeling like a real year that you actually have to think about and have some responsibility for.
You've said that people either, when you talk about it, they either get it right away or they don't get it at all. What do people who don't get it say?
Yeah, I would say that probably 8 out of 10 people that I explain this to me sort of look at me like I'm crazy and politely try to get away as fast as possible. But occasionally, I think you hit somebody who says, yeah, I've been worried about that people really haven't been thinking about the future. And I see why you'd want to stretch it out and really undertake a project that takes a long time. And, you know, there are always people around that like stretching the collective mindset a little bit. And this certainly does that. But when you do that, you have to put up with the fact that most people aren't going to understand what you're doing. So, in fact, there's also a lot of people that really resonate with this idea. And at first, I just started talking about it almost as a hypothetical, a kind of a fantasy. But I found that so many people really got interested in it that I started thinking of it as a serious possibility. In fact, people would start writing out checks to me and handing it and say, well, here's my donation to help build the clock. And so I didn't quite know what to do with these checks. My friend Stuart Brand actually started a foundation and said, okay, well, we're really going to do this project. Let's put together this foundation, which is the Long Now Foundation. And let's make the purpose of the foundation is to get people to think over the long term. And the clock will be our first project. And it's attracted a very interesting kind of eclectic bunch of people, every place from business people to science fiction writers to artists who, for some reason, this idea has struck them as worthwhile and interesting. And there's now a very serious effort to build the clock. I mean, I'm actually designing it. We're looking for a site for it. We're raising funds for it. And that's only one of several projects that the foundation is doing now.
Can you say what a potential site would be?
Well, I guess my image of the clock is that it's someplace far off and remote and hard to get to, so that you really have to make a commitment if you want to go visit it. So maybe it's up at the top of a mountain or in the middle of a desert. So that you might hear about it, and most people will hear about it and never want to go there. But if there's somebody that actually makes the commitment to go there and go look at it and maybe wind it or watch it tick or whatever it is you do when you get there, then I think that whole process, that whole kind of pilgrimage is more likely to be a transformative experience for them than if you just, say, put it in the middle of a city someplace where people would see it every day as they're walking to work.
Daniel Hillis, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Danny Hillis's new book is The Pattern on the Stone,